chapter 24. And the next four chapters, chapters 24 through 27, are a unit that go together, just as chapters 13 through 23 belong to a certain category. They all were burdens that were pronounced against sinful nations. So chapters 24 through 27 provide a picture of judgment upon the land of Israel, followed by certain blessings from God. And the interpretation of these chapters, as I understand it, have been myriad. There have been many different interpretations of these chapters. However, as I read it myself, I personally have no doubt that the majority of it is fairly self-explanatory if we compare it with New Testament thoughts. And so we'll start with chapter 24. I can't guarantee that we'll get through chapter 27. That'd be a lot of chapters to take, but if we could, it wouldn't hurt us. However, I will read just chapter 24 to begin with, and we'll make comments on that before we get into any of the other chapters. "Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. And it shall be as with the people, so with the priest, as with the servant, so with his master, as with the maid, so with his mistress, her mistress, as with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the lender, so with the borrower, as with the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury to him. The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for the Lord hath spoken his word. The earth mourneth and fadeth away. The world languisheth and fadeth away. The haughty people of the earth do languish. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws and changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. The new wine mourneth, the vine languisheth, all the merry-hearted do sigh. The mirth of tabrets ceaseth, the noise of them that rejoice endeth, the joy of the harp ceaseth. They shall not drink wine with a song, strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. The city of confusion is broken down, every house is shut up, that no man may come in. There is a crying for wine in the streets. All joy is darkened, the mirth of the land is gone. In the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. When thus..." Now before we comment, or before we read any further, we should comment on those verses. That does come to a paragraph division. Let's talk about those first 12 verses just for a moment. If you were listening carefully, you notice that it seems to be talking about the end of the world, because it talks about the earth mourning and fading away. It talks about the earth being empty and made waste. It talks about the curse has devoured the earth. However, before we jump to conclusions about the interpretation of the chapter, realize, as I was saying in another class today, that the word earth in the Hebrew is eretz, which also can be translated the land. And this Hebrew word can be translated either way, and in this chapter, in fact, it is interpreted both ways. For example, in verses 1 and 4 and 5 and 6, we find that the word eretz is translated earth in each of those cases. In verse 3, however, the same word eretz is translated land, where it says the land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled. Now, why is it translated earth in several of these verses and yet translated land in verse 3? The answer is, it was the translator's preference. And the question is, what did the writer mean? What did Isaiah mean when he used the term eretz? Did he mean land or did he mean earth? Obviously, the translators themselves acknowledge that the word can be translated either way. And it is apparently the conviction of the King James translators that this is talking about the end of the earth. There is one commentator, J. Sidlow Baxter, who's quite an interesting commentator, but he certainly thinks this is about the end of the world. And he summarizes the layout of the book of Isaiah up to this point in a very interesting way. He says that the first six chapters are prophecies concerning Judah. Then the next six chapters, chapters 7 through 12, are concerning Israel, the northern kingdom. And then chapters 13 through 23 are concerning Gentile nations. And then, as he believes, chapter 24 through 27, the passage that we've come to now, has to do with the end of the world. And in his opinion, the prophet's field of vision is expanding, starting with his own nation. The first chapter is dealing with his own country, Judah, and then expanding to include Israel, and then expanding to the Gentile nations round about, and then finally to the ultimate judgment at the end of the world. And if chapter 24 is talking about the end of the world in this way, then it makes an interesting, it shows an interesting progression in the way that the book is laid out. And some may prefer this particular understanding. For myself, because of the things that follow, and even some of the elements within this passage itself, I prefer to believe that the word earth should uniformly be translated land. And it's an interesting thing, because I've studied the book of Isaiah many times, of course, and I've always, from the context, come to that conclusion. I've always felt like a better translation for the meaning of the passage would be the land rather than the earth. And since that is as valid a translation as any other, I have felt the liberty to feel that way. But most of the commentators I've read up till the present time have supported the King James Version here and translated it earth, and therefore have made it prophecy of the end of the world. John, did you have a question?
Yeah, Israel, south, and Gentile nations, and the world. What was the first one?
Judah.
Judah, and
okay, the first six chapters about Judah. Then the next six chapters about Israel. Then there's those 11 chapters about the Gentile nations, and then this would be prophecies about the end of the world. Okay, so I've been a little uneasy about my understanding of this chapter for several years, because it seems like most of the commentators I read believe it was about the end of the world. And just today and yesterday, I'd consulted some other commentaries I'd never seen before, and they both agreed with me. It was Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and Adam Clark's commentary both agreed with me that this should be translated the land, and that was very comforting to me, because I've always held that view anyway. And it was good to know that some of these classic commentaries, at least there are some others, who see it that way. I've come to my own independent conclusions. The Amplified Bible, for example, in every place in this chapter that speaks of the earth or the land, it just gives both renderings. For instance, we could see it in verse 1. The Amplified reads, "Behold, the Lord will make the land and the earth empty." In other words, it incorporates both possible meanings of eretz, the land and the earth. Which it's only one word in the Hebrew, but the Amplified Version doesn't want to take a stand on which it is, so it says both are implied. And there are some commentators that do seem to think that this picture is a destruction on the land of Judah, or the land of the people of Israel, and also the end of the world. Now, I guess that'd be the safe way to see it. You could see it as touching on both. But for myself, there are many elements in it that seem to focus particularly on the land of Israel. And when you consider it, if you substitute the word earth with the word land, and by that you mean the land of Palestine, the land of Israel, the land of Judah, then it makes plenty of sense. It's talking about a judgment where the Jews will go into exile. And the following chapters would seem to support this. And it is not the earth that's being emptied, but the land of Israel that's being emptied of its inhabitants by, perhaps some think by the Babylonian captivity, some think by what happened in 70 AD at the hands of the Romans. Again, my own personal study of this chapter without the help of commentators has led me to believe that it's talking about what happened in 70 AD. That is, it's looking up into the church age. It's looking at the destruction of Jerusalem, the exportation of the Jews from their land by the Romans in 70 AD as a judgment for their rejection of Christ. And I will seek to show from the following chapters that this is the time frame that this is talking about, that it is not necessarily talking about the end of the world, but the end of the Jewish system and the emptying of the Jewish homeland because of the evil that they've done against the Messiah. Now, before we read it in that light, and before I point out the specific reasons in Isaiah that indicate that to me, I'd like to turn you over to Luke chapter 19. And this is the words of Jesus himself as he was contemplating the judgment that was going to come on Jerusalem in 70 AD. Luke chapter 19, Jesus went up on a mountain and beheld the city of Jerusalem, and he wept over it. And in verse 41 and following, it says, "When he was come near, he beheld the city and wept over it, saying, If you had known, even you, at least in this thy day, the things which belong to thy peace, but now they are hid from thine eyes. For the day shall come upon thee when thine enemy shall cast a trench about thee, and compass thee round, and keep thee in on every side, and shall lay thee even to the ground, and thy children within thee. And they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation. So he talks about the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans that would take place. Now looking just two chapters later in Luke chapter 21, in verse 5, it says, "And as some spake of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, As for these things which ye behold, the days will come in which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And later he was asked, "When shall these things be?" And he gives a lengthy discourse. And in the midst of that discourse about when the temple will be destroyed, and of course this is fulfilled in 70 AD, we can look at what he says later in Luke 21, beginning with verse 23. He says, "But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land," meaning the land of the Jews, the promised land, Israel. And this is talking about 70 AD when the temple would be destroyed. "And wrath upon this people," meaning the Jews, "and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." Now, he said that as the result of the coming Roman armies, when the temple would be destroyed, the city would be destroyed, as he said in chapter 19, both places mention the people being wiped out by their enemies, but in this case he says, besides that, they shall be led away captive into all nations. That is, they will be led out of their land into slavery, which they were. And that, I believe, which Jesus predicted only 40 years before its fulfillment, is what Isaiah predicted some 800 years before its fulfillment. And I believe that Isaiah's passage in chapter 24 is talking about that very thing. And if we would read those same verses and you insert the word land instead of the word earth, which is a valid thing to do in light of the Hebrew there, it would read like this in Isaiah 24. "Behold, the Lord makes the land empty and makes it waste and turns it upside down and scatters abroad the inhabitants thereof." Okay, well, there's the Jews being scattered out of their land. "And it shall be as with the people, so with the priest," and so forth. It basically gives different classes of people, saying that from the top to the bottom, no one will be exempt. The same thing will happen to the common people as happens to the priests. Same thing will happen to the maid as to the mistress. That is, the servant girl and her owner, the buyer and the seller, the lender and the borrower. In other words, those who have money to lend as well as those who are poor and need to borrow. All classes of people in the city will experience this judgment. When it says the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury to him in verse 2. Usury simply means interest. Those who lend on interest and those who pay the interest. All people, regardless of their status in society, will be affected. It'll be the same for all. "The land shall be utterly emptied," verse 3, "and utterly spoiled, for the Lord has spoken his word." And he spoke it again, of course, through Jesus later on in Luke. "The land mourneth and fadeth away. The world languisheth and fadeth away." Now, when it says the world here, this is not the word Eretz. And it might seem like this is necessarily talking about the whole earth. However, in chapter 13, when it was talking about the fall of Babylon, another particular city that fell, it also speaks in terms almost like it's comparing it to a world situation. That was Isaiah 13:11. In the context of the destruction of Babylon, it says, "And I will punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity, and I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease." And then it goes on. So in talking about the fall of a particular city, he may use language that sounds universal, as though it's the whole world coming under this. But really, it's the world of those people who live in this land. It's their world is falling apart. Their world is under judgment. It's the collapse of their world. "The world languisheth and fadeth away. The haughty people of the earth do languish." The land also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Now, this is one of the passages that indicates to me this is talking about Israel rather than the world at large. Because it says they've transgressed the laws and changed the ordinance and broken the everlasting covenant. Well, God had only entered into an everlasting covenant at this point with Jews. He had never entered into such a covenant with the other inhabitants of the world Only the Jews had been given his laws and his ordinances, so those who changed them must have been the Jews to whom they were entrusted. And when it says they've broken the everlasting covenant, this is certainly true of the Jews, but it's hard to imagine how it could be said of the rest of the world in general, who never had such a covenant given to them. Also, when it says the earth or the land also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, this echoes some things that that come up earlier in the Old Testament. For instance, in the book of Numbers, in chapter 35, and this is where Moses is giving the laws about the cities of refuge. It says that if a person accidentally slaughters someone or kills someone, that they could flee to a city of refuge. And if they were innocent, they could stay there safely. If they were not innocent, they would have to be put out of the city and put to death. And verse 33, Numbers 35:33, it says, "So you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood, it defiles the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it." Now it's saying that the land is defiled by the shedding of innocent blood. When a person murders someone, it defiles the land. Now, I dare say our nation, America, is quite defiled because of the shedding of innocent blood of the unborn babies and over 1 million a year who are slain here. Certainly the land has been defiled here also. But the Jews particularly were warned not to defile the land that God was giving them by murder. In Psalm 106, we see another place where this is again applied to Israel, this expression. Psalm 106 and verse 38, it says concerning them, well, 37 and 38, "Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters to devils, and shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood." So again, speaking of the Jews, when they started to worship Molech, like the heathen had, they shed the innocent blood of their sons and daughters, just like modern abortionists do, and to the god of pleasure, Molech, and they defiled their land. Well, these things are said about the Jews in the book of Numbers and in the book of Psalms, and here, speaking probably of the same context, the land also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. The wording of this entire verse, Isaiah 24:5, seems to connect with a Jewish identification of these inhabitants rather than a global world community coming under judgment. There is more to suggest that also. It says, "Therefore the curse devoured the earth," or the land, in verse 6. What curse? It says the curse, as though there's a particular curse in mind. It is the curse that Moses pronounced in Deuteronomy 28 when he said to the Jews, "If you will keep the laws of God, then God will exalt you, Israel, above all nations, and you will be blessed in the city and blessed in the fields and blessed in the fruit of the womb and blessed in your vineyard and blessed in your, you know, everything, blessed." But he says, "But if you turn from these laws and if you do not keep the words of the Lord, then you'll be made the least of the nations, and you'll be cursed in the field and cursed in the house and cursed in your granaries," and so forth. The curse that was pronounced against them if they would depart from the laws of God has come upon them. It's saying here in verse 6, "Therefore hath the curse that Moses pronounced devoured the land." And by the way, in Deuteronomy 28, where Moses pronounced this curse, he said, "And you will be consumed from off the land that God has given you." So it's very clear that part of the curse was that they be driven out of their land, and that seems to be what's described by the prophet here. Again, this has happened more than once in Jewish history. Two times in particular could be realistically suggested as the fulfillment of this prophecy. One would be when the Babylonians came, destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, and exiled the people. The other would be 70 AD when the Romans did the same thing. And both of those occurrences happened after this prophecy was uttered. So a person might say, well, this applies to the Babylonian incident, or they might say it applies to the Roman incident. In my opinion, the Babylonian one only was a type and a foreshadowing of the ultimate destruction of 70 AD. The two resembled each other greatly. And when Moses spoke in some of his warnings of the fact that God would empty them out of their land and so forth, the language that he uses describes, as history now bears out, both times, when the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, and also when the Romans did. The two incidents are so similar, both in the details of their events, and also in just the reasons that God permitted them, that one could be seen rightly, I think, as a type of the other. And so I believe that while this may have some application to the Babylonian exile, I think far more, and as the following verses will indicate, it's talking about what happened to the Jews in 70 AD as the result of their rejection of Christ. I'll again establish that a little further later. But it says, the new wine mourneth, in verse 7, the vine languisheth. You might remember the vineyard parable in Isaiah chapter 5, which was Israel. The vine was the men of Judah in that parable. And he says, now the vine languisheth. It's the people of Judah who are under judgment here, not of the whole earth. And by the way, by the time we get to the end of this section of chapters, in chapter 27, we find a restoration of the vineyard or of the vine, but I'd take it to refer to the church in chapter 27, verses 2 through 11. We'll talk about that when we get there, of course. But here we see the vine languishing. We know in chapter 5 of Isaiah, the vine was the men of Judah, were his pleasant plant and his vine. Then it talks, of course, in general terms about there's no more rejoicing, no more laughter, no more partying. There's only a crying for wine in the streets. Verse 11, people just want to get drunk and forget the woes that are coming upon them. All joy is dark and mirth is gone from the land. Notice there, in verse 11, all mirth of the land. That's Eretz too. The translators chose the word land here. Why? Possibly because of verse 12, the city. In the city is left desolation. Also verse 10, the city of confusion is broken down. There's a particular city in mind, and that would be most naturally understood to be Jerusalem. It's talking about the emptying of the land of Judah and the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Verse 10 says, the city of confusion is broken down. Every house is shut up that no man may come in. It is well known that the civil wars that raged within the city of Jerusalem, within the city walls, when Titus had surrounded the city in 70 AD, that it was so dangerous within the city that people locked their houses up and tried to hide any food they had and tried to save their lives from each other. It says, the city is broken down, every house is shut up that no man can come in. Verse 12, the city is left desolation, the gate is smitten with destruction. Okay, well, all of this points, in my opinion, not to the end of the world, because in a sense, it doesn't seem radical enough to be the end of the world. I mean, some of the language does, but when you think about it, if it's really the end of the world and the world is empty of its inhabitants, who are these people crying in the streets for wine? It doesn't seem like there'd be anyone in the streets or anyone shut up in their houses if we're looking at the end of the world. But if it's just a temporal judgment that comes on the people of Judah and Jerusalem, then we can see this happening. The end of the world is going to be rather sudden, if I don't mistake the New Testament teaching on that. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall be dissolved and the earth shall melt, the elements shall melt with a fervent heat. It doesn't seem like that's going to be very slow and gradual, where people will be spending some time in the streets wishing they could find some wine. It's talking about the end of all joy in the city of Jerusalem, and I believe it's at 70 AD particularly, and we get that also as we read further here. In verse 13, when thus it shall be in the midst of the land, there Eretz is translated land also, and it could have been earth, but we take it as land, as do the translators. You can see the inconsistency of the translators throughout. Among the people there shall be as the shaking of an olive tree, and as the gleaning of grapes when the vintage is done. They shall lift up their voice, they shall sing for the majesty of the Lord, and they shall cry aloud from the sea. Now, this means that when Jerusalem fell, only a remnant, like the gleaning of grapes, only a remnant of them really stayed true to the Lord. And those would be, of course, the Christians. The Christian Jews, the Jews who had turned to Christ, were the remnant that's in view here. It says, wherefore glorify ye the Lord in the fires, even the name of the Lord God of Israel, in the isles of the sea. Now, some people understand this fires to mean the fires of affliction. But actually, the Strong's Concordance, as well as the NIV translation, have understood this to mean the east. Rather than the fires, more the place of the dawning light is what is thought to be intended here. So that the NIV translates it, glorify ye the Lord in the east. And that would seem a reasonable translation when you consider that even the name of the Lord in the isles of the sea realize that from Israel's point of view, the isles of the sea were out to the west. The Mediterranean Sea was on the west side. The east would be the other side, and from the rising of the sun to the going down thereof was from the east to the west. And it would seem like it's simply saying, throughout the earth, where the Jewish believers are now scattered because of the destruction of Jerusalem, wherever they are, whether it's in the east or whether it's in the west, whether they're, you know, no matter where they've gone, they shall sing praises to the Lord. It says in Malachi chapter 1 and verse 11, "For from the rising of the sun," meaning from the east, "even to the going down of the same," meaning to the west, "my name shall be great among the Gentiles, and in every place incense shall be offered unto my name." So God is speaking of a time where the Gentiles themselves, from the east to the west, will be glorifying God and singing praise to Him. That's Malachi 1:11. And that would seem to agree with this statement in Isaiah 24:15. "Glorify the Lord in the east" is probably the better translation. "Even the name of the Lord from the isles of the sea," which would be the west, from the vantage point of Jerusalem. Then it says in verse 16, "From the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous." Now, we've talked about how God's people are going to have glory upon them, that the glory of the Lord is going to be seen upon them. Now, we are called to receive and obtain and inherit the glory of God. So he hears a song that celebrates this fact, that glory is going to be to the righteous. Notice, the song is being sung so that he hears it coming from the uttermost part of the earth. Now, the uttermost parts of the earth suggest the part that's furthest from Jerusalem. Someone told me that geographically, the uttermost part of the earth from Jerusalem is the South Island of New Zealand, where there happens to be a city called Christ Church. And that is the point that is the furthest geographically from Jerusalem. And it's interesting that Jesus said in Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, "When the Holy Spirit has come upon you, you shall be my witnesses in Judea," or in Jerusalem, in Judea, and Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth. The same expression that's used here. From the point where he was standing, the uttermost parts of the earth now has a place called Christ Church, which is kind of, I think, an interesting fulfillment of that prophecy. Well, the point here is not that he's talking about Christ Church New Zealand, but rather that the whole world, including the furthest point from Jerusalem, is resounding with righteous people who are celebrating the glory of the Lord that is given to them. And this I take to be something that is happening right now, that in every part of the world there are Christians rejoicing in the hope of the glory of God, as it says in Romans 5:2. So, from the uttermost parts of the earth he hears the song of celebration, yet Jerusalem itself, I mean, let's bring it back down home, what's happening in Jerusalem? "I said," and here the prophet seems to be speaking for the nation itself, my leanness, woe unto me, the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously, yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth," or I would prefer the land. "And it shall come to pass that he who fleeth from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit. And he that cometh out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare. For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth," or of the land, "do shake." Now, he talks about those who seek to flee from the danger. And they flee from the noise of the fear, and they fall into a pit. Those who manage to get up out of the pit fall into another trap. If you would read Josephus' account, who was the Jewish historian who gave an interesting and secular report of what happened when Jerusalem was besieged in 70 AD, there were a few Jews who tried to defect because things were so bad within the city during the siege that some Jews managed to escape the city and flee to the Romans, most of whom were slain by the Romans, or sometimes they fled to the Arabs, and the Arabs, because they had heard that some of the Jews had swallowed gold and things to smuggle out of the city to take with them, the Arabs just disemboweled people, seeing if there was any gold in their stomachs when they came to them. I mean, it was a gross, horrible judgment that came upon Jerusalem, and those who sought to flee the danger in the city found danger outside the city. There was no escape from the judgment of God in this case. And when it says, "For the windows from on high are open," it means, of course, that this is not just a natural consequence of political lust of nations against another, but this is a judgment from God like the flood of Noah is. In the flood of Noah, we remember the windows of heaven were open and God's judgment poured out from them. Here it's stating that there's no escape from this judgment, because if it was just men exercising their wrath, you as another man might be able to pit your forces against his and somehow manage to get out of it with your life. But this isn't a judgment from men, this is from God. It's the windows of heaven that are open and the foundations of the earth or of the land do shake. In other words, it's like an earthquake. It's far beyond man's control. It's something that God alone can govern, and it's a judgment directly from Him. Again, the earth or the land is utterly broken down. The land is clean dissolved. The land is moved exceedingly. The land shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage. The word cottage here in the Hebrew should be translated, some think it should be translated like a hammock, which was used by a watchman when the troops were out in the wilderness. The watchman at night would rest in a hammock hung from two trees up high enough where wild animals couldn't get him, but where he could also see some distance. And it was basically a temporary place of lodging for the night. Now, the idea here is that Israel, the land of Israel, had been, in a sense, considered God's habitation. Jerusalem and the temple in Jerusalem had been his house. But it's going to be removed as though it was never a permanent thing at all. It was a temporary residence. It was a temporary stopping off place for God, like a temporary lodging for a night. It's going to be removed like you'd pick up your tent and move along, or like you'd roll up your hammock at the end of the night's sleep. In other words, rather than Jerusalem being unconditionally God's home, it's more like it's temporary. It's something that when the judgment comes upon it, it's going to be removed as much as if it had only been a place of resting for one night that God had lodged in. And the transgressions thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. Now, this is one reason that I think this probably refers more to Rome's invasion in 70 AD than Babylonian, because though Jerusalem fell to Babylon, it did rise again. It was rebuilt by Zerubbabel and Nehemiah and their co-workers. And so this wouldn't seem to refer to that, but when the Romans destroyed it, in a sense it hasn't risen again. Now there is a city of Jerusalem, of course, today, but it has not risen again in the sense that God has not restored it. He did restore it. He deliberately restored it after the Babylonian captivity. But God has not spoken anywhere that He would restore it after the Roman destruction. The Roman destruction is spoken of in the New Testament as though that was going to be the final thing that God would do with Jerusalem, and therefore I would see this more as applying to 70 AD than to the Babylonian invasion and destruction of Jerusalem. On the other hand, the expression "and not rise again" might not necessarily mean ever. It might simply mean in the convulsions that are being described here in this particular setting, it'd be like a drunkard that falls, and then he gets to his feet, then he falls, then he gets to his feet, then he falls, and he doesn't get up anymore. That is to say, within, he's talking like staggering like a drunkard. The city is drunk with its sins, and it can't stand before God, and it's kind of convulsing and trying to get up and everything, but it will fall and lie there still. And this might not mean, as we would tend to take it, that it will never ever rise again, but simply that it will fall and then it will lie still. It won't be getting up forever. It'll finally collapse. But that it could be restored later by God is not out of the question necessarily. However, when we get to verse 21, we see something very interesting, at least I find very interesting. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high. And almost all commentators agree with what we would ordinarily see in this, a reference to the principalities and powers and the rulers of the darkness of this world and the wicked ones in high places. This is talking about demonic powers that God would punish in that day. God will punish the demonic power. Now, of course, the Jews, or the Jewish prophets, I should say, under inspiration of the Scripture, identified the idols of the heathen with demons. We saw a moment ago in Psalm 106 and verse 37. Psalm 106:37. It was talking about how the Jews sacrificed their children to Moloch, but it says they sacrificed their children to demons. Moloch was an idol, but basically it says it was demons that that were being sacrificed to. Behind the idols were demonic powers. Also in 1 Corinthians 10:20, Paul says, "Know you not that the sacrifices that the heathen offer, they offer to demons and not to God?" 1 Corinthians 10:20. So the worship of idols is the worship of demons. I mean, God's saying he's going to punish the demons. He might be simply saying he's going to punish the idols and the demonic powers behind them. Now, this could be seen to apply to the Babylonian captivity because, well, let me read the passage and I'll tell you why I say that. But I also think it could apply to the Roman one, and I'll tell you why also. "It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high and the kings of the earth upon the earth," or the land, that is. "And they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days shall they be visited." The visited could refer to in judgment, or it could refer to mercy. The Hebrew word does not distinguish between the two concepts. "Then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously." Now, it talks about him punishing the hosts of the high ones and the kings of the land. When Babylon came in and wiped out Jerusalem, the prophets said that this was happening because the Jews had gotten involved in idolatry, and God was judging them for their idolatry. We find that in Babylon, in the 70 years the Jews were captives there, that they were cured of their idolatry. They never established idols in their land again, although they'd been chronic idolaters. I mean, through the book of Judges, through the books of Kings, the Jews had chronically fallen into idolatry just about every other generation. But the Babylonian captivity cured them. In a sense, God judged the idolatry. God judged the idols, the high ones that had been worshipped by his people through that event. And in saying that the kings of the land will be judged, we know that three of the Davidic kings of Jerusalem came under one kind or another judgment from Nebuchadnezzar. One had his eyes put out and was led captive. Another was led captive without that problem. I think one was killed. But the kings of the land were punished. The demonic powers behind the idols that were worshipped were punished. And when it talks about they shall be gathered like prisoners, are taken into the pit, this would possibly be a picture of the Babylonian captivity. The people, the kings and their people are taken in as prisoners to Babylon, and they shall be shut up in the prison. And after many days they shall be visited, could refer to the restoration of the Jews from Babylon at the end of the 70 years. Now that is one interpretation that is possible. On the other hand, if we are seeing this mainly as a description of what happened in 70 AD, then we're not talking about the same kind of prison situation. I feel that there's a possible reference here to the binding of the demonic powers as prisoners. That it's not a mention of the Jews being as prisoners for a period of time, but the demonic powers, including Satan, being bound. You remember that Jesus said that he had bound the strong man in Matthew 12:28. He said, "No man can enter into a strong man's house," meaning Satan's domain, "and plunder his house," as Jesus was doing, "unless he has first bound the strong man." So he was indicating that since he was in the process of plundering Satan's house, he must necessarily have bound him. And you recall that in two other places in the New Testament, in the book of Jude and in 2 Peter chapter 2, we are told that the demons, the angels that kept not their first estate, they are kept reserved in chains under darkness awaiting the judgment of the great day. Now, these passages give us cause to wonder what is meant by being bound, because it says in two places that the fallen angels are bound in chains under darkness. Jesus said Satan was bound. And of course, Revelation 20 describes a similar thing, Satan being bound with a chain. These are all figurative statements, of course, but the question is, what does it mean? Now, one thing we know for sure, Satan is still active, and so are the demons. We run into them from time to time. They still possess people, for example. And the devil is not totally inactive. Yet, both are said to be bound. I mean, the scripture says in no uncertain terms that Jesus had bound the strong man and that the demons themselves are reserved in chains under darkness. This must imply, of course, that their binding is figurative for something, apparently a limitation of their freedom to a great extent, but apparently not total, because we know that Satan also is active in the world as well as being said to have been bound. I mean, it says in Hebrews 2:15, that Jesus through death, no, Hebrews 2:14, that through death Jesus destroyed him that had the power of death, that is the devil. And the word destroyed there is katergeo, which means to render inactive or to reduce to inactivity. Now that's a strange statement, because it says there in the Greek that Jesus, through his death, rendered Satan inactive or reduced him to inactivity. But again, we know he's not totally inactive. So this picture of Satan being bound, the picture of him being reduced to inactivity, the picture of the demons being in chains, these are images which apparently are not to be understood too absolutely, because we know that these beings are still at large in some measure and in some way. But we can see that a tremendous judgment has come upon the powers of darkness at the cross, that Jesus did deal a tremendous blow to the powers of darkness, so that it could easily be said that their freedom to deceive the world has been greatly limited. After all, realize that before Jesus came, only the Jews had any light from God. The Gentiles, for the most part, didn't have any prophets. They didn't have any angels visiting them. They were in darkness, and their religions show what kind of darkness they were in. They were worshiping demons. In other words, the whole world was in the lap of the wicked one. The whole world was in deception until Jesus came. But when Jesus commissioned his disciples to go into all the world and preach gospel to every nation, he was moving into the devil's turf. And the devil would not be able to withstand him. He said the gates of hell would not prevail against his church, which implies that Satan has been greatly limited, that some tremendous binding or tying of Satan's hands has taken place that makes it impossible for him to resist the onslaught of a militant church. So that as the church moves forward into the territory that was once Satan's, Satan is, as it were, his hands are tied. He can't resist it. He can try to put up a fight, but if the church persists, he's at a loss to stop us, because the weapons of our warfare are mighty through God to the pulling down of those strongholds. And we have weapons that can defeat him. Therefore, though he is not, as we would interpret the word inactive, he's not completely doing nothing. He is certainly not he's not given up his business of deceiving people, yet with respect to his global ability to deceive the world that he once possessed, he has been greatly, greatly reduced to inactivity. That is to say, his powers to control the situation have been greatly limited. So when Jesus said he had bound the strong man, we know Satan was still walking loose, because later Jesus said, "Now shall the prince of this world be cast down." And he also said, "The prince of this world cometh and has nothing in me." And, you know, the prince of the world was still doing things, but he was also bound in some sense. I believe that we need to understand the imprisonment of Satan and the incarceration of the demons as a figure of speech that speaks of the great defeat that they have experienced at the cross, which renders them incapable of continuing to deceive the world as the church moves forward with the gospel. And you know, it's an interesting thing, when the image of Satan being bound in Revelation 20 occurs, it says that he was bound with a great chain so that he might not deceive the nations anymore. In other words, the particular sense in which he is said to be bound is with respect to his ability to deceive the world. And then when he is loosed, later in that same chapter, it says he shall be loosed from his prison and he shall go forth to deceive the nations again, Gog and Magog, and to bring them to the battle of the great day. Now, both cases, where he's loosed and where he's bound, or he's bound and loosed, make reference to his ability or inability to deceive the nations, to deceive the world. That is, the binding of Satan seems to be a restricting of his ability that he once had to keep the whole world in darkness. And that certainly is a restriction that we do see. Every one of you were once in darkness, and now Satan has lost you. Because you were Gentiles, you were of the nations, you weren't a Jew. Well, every one of us was from a tribe that would not have been reached if Jesus hadn't come, because the Jews weren't coming to get us, you know. They weren't coming to evangelize us, and we would have been Satan's territory. But Jesus got us, and Satan couldn't stop him. And so we have to be familiar with this image. After all, there's another case in the New Testament, Colossians 2 and verse 15, which says that